Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 4th of January. Our main stories. President Trump has said the US killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani to stop a war, not to start one. But Iran says the assassination was an act of international terrorism, and it will respond at a time and place of its choosing.
The same thing they did to us should be done to them. Their leaders should be killed.
We will take a revenge so harsh that their bright day will turn into a dark night.
Also in the podcast, the Chinese health authorities say they're investigating the source of a mysterious virus. And we have an eyewitness account from Zambia, which is facing the threat of famine after 2 years of poor rains and failed harvests. Outside Iran, he may not have been a household name, but General Qasem Soleimani was hugely influential across the Middle East. A top military commander, he was seen as Iran's second most powerful man, directing overseas operations, notably in Syria, Lebanon and Iraq. And that is ultimately what led to his assassination in an American airstrike, with President Trump blaming him for murdering hundreds of American civilians and servicemen. Iran has said the US will face inescapable consequences at a time and place of its choosing. We'll hear more on that in a moment. But our first report is from our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen.
Qasem Soleimani was killed by a missile fired from an American drone as he left Baghdad airport. Among the rest of the dead in his motorcade was a top Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandis, a leader of one of the pro-Tehran Shia militias that Soleimani made sure were well-armed and trained. They played a big role in the fight against the jihadist extremists of Islamic State, but were also a vital part of Iran's capacity to project power outside its borders. The drone attack followed a series of escalating and deadly exchanges between the US and pro-Iranian militiamen in Iraq, culminating in attempts to storm the US embassy in Baghdad after the Americans killed 25 militia fighters in an airstrike. Qasem Soleimani was no ordinary foe. The Americans have removed an obdurate and effective enemy and delivered a blow to the heart of the Iranian regime. For many years, Soleimani built up Iran's power outside its borders and made it, and himself, a major player in wars in Iraq, Syria and Lebanon. He was a talisman for Iranian hardliners who've been rocked to their core. The country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said what he called severe revenge was awaiting the criminals behind the attack, a sentiment echoed by the commander of Iran's army, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi. There will be a crushing response, he says, and warns of the annihilation of terrorists and terrorist supporters, including the US terrorist regime. The assassination is a risky move in a region that was already tense and full of violence. Both sides will not want uncontrolled escalation. But the chances of miscalculation, misperception, and a slide into a much bigger war have increased greatly. It is not at all clear whether the assassination fits into a coherent US strategy. Soleimani was America's enemy for a generation. They must have had other chances to kill him, which presumably they chose not to take because of the repercussions that could follow.
Our Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen. Well, given that previous caution, why has the US chosen to act now? In a statement in Florida, President Trump said Qasem Soleimani had been involved in terror plots as far afield as New Delhi and London and was killed to save Americans from imminent terror attacks.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him. Soleimani made the death of innocent people his sick passion. Today we remember and honor the victims of Soleimani's many atrocities, and we take comfort in knowing that his reign of terror is over. We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war.
For more details on what President Trump had to say and the thinking behind it, we spoke to Gary O'Donoghue in Washington.
You heard from the president's lips the justification for the killing of Soleimani, and he talked, like his Secretary of State did, about imminent attacks, imminent and sinister attacks, he said, that were being planned in the region by Soleimani. He went over the history of the other attacks, laying the responsibility for those firmly at Soleimani's feet. He said, I thought quite strikingly, he said, we didn't act to start a war last night, we acted to stop a war, really chiming in with that whole idea that this was a sort of defensive action on the part of the United States to stop Soleimani doing the things he was planning to do. And interestingly also, I think, from the president, him reiterating or saying out loud, which he didn't have to say this, we're not seeking regime change in Iran. So pretty sort of even tone, not the sort of bellicosity as you often get from the president in these situations. This was much more sort of commander-in-chief-like. This was straight down the line. I mean, it still leaves a lot of questions unanswered, but he wants to get the message out there that this was justified because of what was coming next, potentially, from Soleimani. But I think, there, as I said, there will still be those who will want more specifics. What was about to happen? What was so imminent that needed this kind of ratcheting up of the stakes?
Gary O'Donoghue. So what will Iran do now? The government there has been under pressure in recent weeks as a result of its economic woes. Recent protests in Iran were met with unprecedented force, resulting in hundreds of deaths. But the killing of General Soleimani led to a display of support for the authorities and an outpouring of anger against the US.
Mad, bad America!
Mad, bad
Israel!
We must give them the most crushing response. If it was me, I would have launched 50 missiles against America right now.
The same thing they did to us should be done to them. Their leaders should be killed. All of them should be killed.
We will take a revenge so harsh that their bright day will turn into a dark night. Now is the time to say, Yankee, go home.
Mad, bad America!
Well, the current deterioration in relations between the US and Iran accelerated when President Trump unilaterally withdrew from the international deal under which Iran agreed to restrict its nuclear program in return for an easing of sanctions. One of those on Iran's negotiating team at the talks was Professor Saeed Mohammed Mirandi. This was his reaction to the killing.
Well, since this was an act of war and the United States murdered a senior Iranian official and military commander, there is extraordinary outrage in Iran and demands that Iran punish the United States. And the same is true in Iraq. The Americans also murdered a senior Iraqi commander who at the airport received General Soleimani at the Baghdad International Airport, and he too was murdered and killed alongside his entourage. And therefore, the outrage among most Iraqis is quite clear and open, and I think that the Americans are miscalculating by behaving like a rogue regime that disregards Iraqi sovereignty, that murders at will, that ignores the orders of the Iraqi prime minister, that has an embassy the size of a country in Baghdad, that behaves like an imperial power. This is not going to serve American interests, and I think the Americans will soon recognize that its position in Iraq is no longer sustainable.
Saeed Mohammed Mirandi. The US has a huge presence in the Middle East, so how vulnerable is it to an Iranian response? I asked our defence and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus.
Well, a huge military footprint, a smaller one than in the past, but one that's in the process of being reinforced as we speak. Some 5,000 US troops at the moment in Iraq itself, a much smaller outpost in eastern Syria, obviously bases throughout the region, a naval presence in the Gulf with a headquarters in Bahrain. Then there are, of course, diplomatic posts, embassies, consulates and so on, and indeed commercial activities too. Remember also that the Iranians in the past have mounted terrorist operations abroad, attacks in Latin America, attempted attacks in Europe and elsewhere. So one can't necessarily confine any response to US targets in simply the Middle East. But I think beyond that, you have to weigh up, you know, is there going to be one major attack, proportionate, if you like, to the killing of this general? Or are we going to see a whole range, a whole upsurge of Iranian activities in different countries in the region where they hold sway, where they have groups who are closely allied to Tehran? Iraq is a case in point. Are we going to see a much greater upsurge and pressure on the Iraqi government from pro-Iranian militia groups in that country? Remember, it was missile attacks by those groups on American bases in Iraq that was the start of the trail that led to this US drone strike against General Soleimani.
Well, interestingly, in Iraq, there were some celebrations after the news of this assassination emerged because some people there don't like the Iranian influence. But where does this leave the Middle East? Obviously, Iranians will be hugely angered, but the man who ran all these groups is now gone.
Well, he's gone, but his deputy has been appointed in his place, who may or may not be as capable. I doubt that he's as capable, because Soleimani was a remarkable figure, whatever one may think of him. He had a strategic view. He had a sense of risk-taking that seemed always, by and large, to pay off. The Middle East is a much more dangerous place than it was before. Now, before we all run away with concerns about Middle East wars, and this is very much a European perspective, of course, if you think about Libya, if you think about Yemen, if you think about Syria and so on, the people have been undergoing awful conflicts there. In many places, they still are. There's famine, there's shortage of supplies, the bombing of medical installations and so on. So it's a pretty grim place in many ways already. This could make things a lot worse. It's a funny thing, you know. Ideally, in a world, we'd like there to be an Iran and America that could get along with each other, that would be countries with which each could do business. At the other extreme, we clearly don't want a full-scale war between the two countries. But in the middle, there has been a kind of level of low-level warfare, undeclared warfare between them for decades. The envelope, if you like, in which that operated expanded over recent months, and not least, I think, in part because of signals from the United States that it was less and less interested in the region. Maybe General Soleimani and his commanders in the Quds Force took advantage of that to expand their activities, shooting down an American drone not so long ago last year, the attack on oil installations in Saudi Arabia. Whatever was in the works, and we don't know, we heard from Washington there, something was in the works that the Americans found out about, we believe, but we don't know what it was. That clearly seems to have been sufficient to alter the balance and to lead to a green light being given by the president for this particular strike.
Our defence and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. Other news now, and the authorities in southeast Australia are urging tens of thousands of people to move to safety because of fears that wildfires could get worse over the weekend. High winds and soaring temperatures could push the blazes into more heavily populated areas, including parts of outer Sydney. In the state of Victoria, the Australian Navy has evacuated around 1,000 people trapped in the fire-ravaged resort of Mallacoota. One resident, Etienne van der Mendev, described the scene.
The houses up on the crest of the hill got the full force, and we could hear it from here, and it was like freight trains going through the sky. Enormous noise and terribly frightening. We could see the fire and the flames, and the sky was red.
Etienne van der Mendev in Australia. Well, another part of the world affected by extreme weather at the moment is Zambia. Parts of the country are on the brink of famine as a result of 2 years of poor rains and failed harvests. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding has been investigating the story. Here's part of a recent report by him.
When did you last eat, Esther?
Me, almost 2 days without getting food. There's nowhere to get food.
You must be hungry.
Hey, we are hungry. I am hungry.
Well, Andrew is now back in Johannesburg, from where he spoke to my colleague Divya Arya about what he'd seen on his most recent trip to Zambia and the woman in his report.
That was Esther Simamvavwa. She's 65. She came up to us as we were watching this food delivery, the World Food Programme and other organisations like World Vision and the Zambian authorities handing out food in an area near Lake Kariba, this beautiful giant lake that forms the border between Zambia and Zimbabwe. It's downstream from Lake Victoria. And she, Esther, had come to get her own share of food aid and said that, you know, this village, this area was used to hard times, used to droughts, but that this year was unusually tough and unusually worrying for the community because the rains, the pattern of rains that farming communities all across Zambia have come to rely on for centuries are being disrupted now in ways that people have not seen before.
You use the word unusual many times. So Zambia is not used to this kind of drought or famine?
It's used to periodic droughts. It's used to hardship. There is malnourishment often in these rural areas. But what everyone we spoke to said was that this is becoming very different, that rain is coming from time to time, but it's not falling with the consistency that they're used to. The rains in particular are coming now a couple of months later. And what you're getting now are pockets of good rainfall and then large areas that are overlooked altogether, or they experience a day or two of heavy rain, but that isn't enough to grow crops because a lot of these villages in this particular area don't have easy access to rivers or to borehole water, and so they are very much dependent on seasonal rains.
From the sounds of it, this could have some links to climate change. Is that linkage being drawn there?
It is very much. And of course, when you look at any individual incident, for instance, we've seen a lot of reporting about the Great Victoria Falls, which have run dry. People can say, well, look, that happens most years, and it happens much more extremely in some years rather than others. And droughts, as you and I both mentioned, are not uncommon in this part of Africa. But when you step back a little and start to look at the patterns, then the experts are saying that, no, this is becoming something that they feel they can now link to climate change. And the concern is that, according to climate change experts, to the scientists, this part of southern Africa is likely to experience global warming at twice the rate that much of the rest of the world is going to experience it.
Andrew Harding talking to Divya Arya. And still to come on the podcast...
Here the big question is whether Chinese-owned TikTok continues its ascent, surging past the likes of Instagram and Snapchat as a favourite teen hangout. If so, 2020 may be the year we all have to learn to lip-sync.
Our technology correspondent on what may be in store in the year ahead for social media. A mysterious virus has struck in the city of Wuhan in central China. 44 people have been infected. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more.
It's a type of viral pneumonia. The authorities have ruled out that it's not influenza, it's not avian influenza, and it's not an adenovirus infection. Crucially, they haven't ruled out anything to do with SARS, that severe acute respiratory syndrome. It's a coronavirus. It became famous back in 2002, 2003, and it killed around 770 people globally across 37 countries. Incredibly infectious virus, deadly among those people, elderly people who caught it. And so really, crucially, the government hasn't ruled out that one key virus yet.
Of course, when you get a virus like this spreading quickly, people don't know what's happening. Lots of rumours, and the authorities are trying to clamp down on that.
Yeah, they've already punished 8 people for spreading what they said were online rumours. And I think, really, they're incredibly nervous right now. So we have a case where the health authorities have been briefing, they've been saying what they've been trying to investigate. They have been releasing updates every few days, even though they're a bit scanty, really, in what they've been saying. But I think they're really nervous, crucially, because we're just about to enter the Chinese New Year period. Chinese New Year is quite spread early this year. It falls on January 25th. Ahead of that, starting, you know, 2 weeks before that day, is when the entire country, basically, it's the largest human migration on Earth, when everyone in China will get up and go back to their hometowns, huge travel period. This is not the period when the Chinese government wants, A, a mystery virus to be spreading, or B, rumors about a mystery virus to be spreading. And so I think really the health authorities are under some intense pressure right now to figure out really what this virus is.
And do the authorities have a good record of dealing with things like this? You mentioned SARS.
Well, yeah, I mean, SARS is a fascinating case. It was actually my first big story as a journalist in China, and it highlighted a lot of things, a lot of problems with the Chinese health system back then. It showed that the health system really was very fragile and shoddy. Frankly, not a lot has changed, especially in Chinese rural areas, but China did really learn a lesson about transparency. Now, it did have to come forward, famously, back in 2003 and admit that it had been covering up the number of SARS cases. It had to fire its health minister and the mayor of Beijing. It's only because one elderly doctor came forward and blew the whistle on the cover-up. So I think apparently they said they learned a lot of lessons back then about the need for transparency when a virus like this is spreading. Let's hope they remember that lesson.
Celia Hatton. Ethical veganism, where people not only have a vegan diet but refuse to use animals as a commodity in any way, has been declared a philosophical belief by a judge in the UK. The ruling came during a case at an employment tribunal brought by Jordi Casamitjana, who claims he was sacked because of his beliefs. His former employer, the League Against Cruel Sports, says he was actually fired for gross misconduct, and it didn't dispute his contention that ethical veganism was a belief. So why did the tribunal examine this issue, and what does the judgment mean? Our legal correspondent is Clive Coleman.
Jordi Casamitjana alleges that when he drew his bosses at the League Against Cruel Sports attention to the fact that some of their pension funds were invested in companies involved in animal testing, that they did nothing about it, he claims, and he then told fellow employees, and that he was sacked as a result. So what he was arguing is that he was discriminated against on the basis of his ethical vegan belief. And this hearing was all about whether that belief would qualify as a philosophical belief akin to a religion and therefore be protected under UK equality law in the same way that a religion is.
So anyone who's a vegan will now feel that they have stronger protection from the courts?
If they're an ethical vegan, and the distinction is this, if you're simply a dietary vegan, you choose to eat plant-based food. But if you're an ethical vegan, as Jordi Casamitjana is, it informs pretty much every aspect of your life. Just to give you one example, he declines to travel by bus in case the bus accidentally crashes into a bird or an insect. So it's all-encompassing for him. But in order for a philosophical belief to qualify for protection, it has to tick certain boxes. So it has to be a genuinely held, serious belief, not an opinion. It has to cover a substantial aspect of human life, be worthy of respect in a democratic society, and not interfere with the rights of others. But the judge in this case found that it did all of those things. And I guess the question is, what are the implications? Can someone, for instance, sitting on the till at a supermarket who's an ethical vegan refuse to put a meat product through the till because they're an ethical vegan? Let's take other belief systems. Let's say someone who is very involved in campaigning on climate change. Could they, for instance, refuse to drive around the country in a car that's been provided by their employer because it's leaving too heavy a carbon footprint? In either of those circumstances, if the person is disciplined as a result of holding those beliefs, then potentially they have a claim.
Our legal affairs correspondent, Clive Coleman. French police say they've shot dead a man who stabbed a number of people in a park near Paris. One of the stabbing victims has died. Rooster Pooker reports.
The attack took place in Villejuif, south of the French capital, early in the afternoon. The armed man started assaulting people in a local park, seemingly at random. He killed one and injured at least two, one of them critically, before fleeing from the site. The police caught up with him in a nearby shopping centre. They say it was clear he was intent on continuing the attack there, and officers opened fire, killing the man. There's been no word on the motive for the assault, but counter-terrorism prosecutors are assessing the case.
Rooster Pooker. Finally, in this edition, the latest in our series of predictions from our specialist correspondents. It's the turn of Rory Coughlan-Jones, so here's his look at what might happen in the world of technology in 2020.
Is this the year that the dream of seamless connectivity with everybody and everything communicating with the internet at lightning speed becomes a reality? I'm talking about 5G, the next generation of mobile phone networks. It's sort of arrived in 2019, but just about nobody has a 5G phone yet. So all eyes are on what could be the moment that the technology takes off in September. That's when Apple is expected to release an iPhone with 5G capabilities. Once this new world dawns, everything should, in theory, get faster. The streaming revolution, which took off with 4G, making Netflix one of the biggest generators of web traffic, will accelerate. And soon we'll be streaming not just films and TV shows, but games. Google Stadia got off to a quiet start in 2019. To use the game streaming service, you need a really solid internet connection. And only when fast fibre and 5G are rolled out more widely will a critical mass of gamers arrive on this and rival services. Our homes too are being changed by a combination of seamless connectivity and artificial intelligence. The rise of smart speakers is one example. Expect them to be in more homes offering more services. As the Internet of Things becomes a reality, every appliance in your home, from the washing machine to the doorbell, will be sending vast amounts of data to the cloud. That will bring more privacy worries, as will the spread of facial recognition systems, not just for logging on to your phone, but for watching over public places. If your face is on a banned list, the technology could exclude you from a concert or a football match. In the field of transport, 2020 is when electric motoring could have a breakthrough moment. After years when Tesla has stolen all the headlines, the traditional manufacturers are launching models ranging from the Ford Mustang Mach-E to BMW's electric Mini to the Volkswagen ID.3. But in another area, expect slower progress. We've been promised autonomous cars for some years, but the pioneers have been hitting several road bumps. The technology is 98% there, but the last 2% is the hardest. And then there's the challenge of getting other road users to mix peacefully with robot cars. And finally, the unpredictable world of social media. And here the big question is whether Chinese-owned TikTok continues its ascent, surging past the likes of Instagram and Snapchat as a favourite teen hangout. If so, 2020 maybe the year we all have to learn to lip sync.
Our technology correspondent, Rory Coughlan-Jones. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.